Okay, this is side two of session 26, January 8th, 2007. Just to finish up what I was saying about YouTube is that somebody taped George Allen in Virginia making a racist remark, and they put that up on YouTube. It got around quickly without major media coverage, and then I guess the major media got onto it because it became a big item on YouTube. But there was all kinds of stuff like that going out there that the audience was enjoying because they could get it immediately through YouTube. Gave them an autonomy of bypassing the major news outlets. And I heard someone say that Al Jazeera is Bin Laden's YouTube because they can put so much on-the-ground videotapes of whatever, America's being blown up.
Oh.
All the violence right there and get it out all over the world.
That's his private YouTube.
Yeah, Al Jazeera is the, you know, the CNN of the Middle East, and they're seeing it as, or Western journalists and cultural commentators are seeing it as Bin Laden's YouTube.
Right.
So anyways, the YouTube, we can look at the new environment using the McLuhan meme. If there's new technology, what are the immediate shifts? And the immediate shift may have been the consensus that we can all be outraged at Bush, even though those that were in power in Congress before YouTube in 2001, 2002 were lockstep and looking like victims, willing, consenting victims of Big Brother leading up to the war. Suddenly, things change rapidly. And I was hearing someone say, I don't know, some commentator saying, you know, they're talking about, we've got to pull out because 3,000 people died in Iraq. He says, we're in a major war. Back in World War II, you had 3,000 dead every day.
Mm.
And so it's interesting how people project a World War II thing on this. They're probably aware it's a different kind of situation.
Yeah, but some people are arguing this is bad because it's already gone longer than World War II.
Yeah.
And other people are saying this is puny compared to World War II.
Right. And the and so people are saying Americans aren't tough enough to take the casualties. And I was just saying we don't even need to have any casualties because it was all a fake war in the beginning. So that'll go on. Yelling and screaming. So we're going to do the next quote, which is IB is the code. I looked it up in the index. It stands for William Irwin Thompson's essay called It's Already Begun in a magazine called In Context, Winter 1985-86 period. So this is actually just slightly before the quote we did on the Democratic Party and 5 years or so before the quote we just did on electoral peasantry in the retrieved Middle Ages. So this is on page 65 and 67 of my book. So you want to read this one? Oh, did I say, I don't know if I said that the quote on electoral peasantry was page 31 in that journal called The Quest.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't give the page number, page 31. This quote we're doing, and just in case, the Democratic Party quote was on page 15 of the book, or the article, A Guy in Politics in the Whole Earth Review. So just in case I didn't say that, if anybody wants to look them up. And this new quote is on page 28 and 29 of the magazine In Context in the winter issue of 85-86.
Okay.
Okay?
So we're going back 5 years from the previous quote.
Yeah.
Let's see. Is this book online anywhere?
My book?
Yeah, the one we're reading.
I have it in
other
the
words,
file.
We're going to have
not online.
At some point.
Couldn't put it online. Too many quotes requires copyright permission.
Oh.
So I sent it to people privately, and somebody put up the Dobbs section on Five Bodied. The whole Dobbs section is up there.
Right.
So were you going to say that this should go online?
Well, anybody that has gotten this far in these tapes that we're doing probably should have the text. So maybe there's a way that they could email somebody and get a copy of it or something.
Yeah, well, email me and ask me.
Yeah. Okay.
So this quote begins, "The recognition of the civilizational unconscious."
Right. The recognition of this civilizational unconscious, this hidden cultural reality, is the end of a process that began intellectually in the early 20th century. Freud began with the instinctive unconscious. Jung followed him and reflected the instinctive life into consciousness as it was created in the collective unconscious and reflected in patterns of imagery that would occur in science or poetry or dreams or the rest of it. It wasn't instinct. It was instinct reflected in imagery creating consciousness. The third wave came in Paris with people like Levi Strauss and Foucault, who studied the intellectual unconscious. Foucault looked at the epoch from the 17th century to now and said there's a hidden framework that unites economics, linguistic theory, art, and philosophy, yet no one in the 17th century was really aware of these hidden correspondences. So Foucault, in a sense, discovered the intellectual unconscious. Levi Strauss went off to the Amazon and showed how if you looked at all the mythologies of South America, there are these hidden patterns and hidden structures that the people telling the stories don't see. It's only the ethnographer writing the mythology, and that's italicized, the ethnographer writing the mythology who can show you the intellectual unconscious. Now, in the later 60s, following the work of the French thinkers, Gregory Bateson, using cybernetics, showed that there is actually a civilizational unconscious, that mind is not separate from nature, that mind is in nature, and that in many ways the ecology is the unconscious of the societal system. So what we have in pollution, for example, is a real expression of the being of humanity in this moment of time. What we have in our conscious structures, our institutions, are the Disneyland movie sets.
So what do you get from that?
Well, this seems pretty sophisticated. And why don't you begin commenting on this?
Well, okay, so revolving around the world, the word unconscious. So McLuhan said that for civilized man or literate and print man, there was an unconscious. For pre-literate and post-literate man, there is no unconscious. So McLuhan's saying that the unconscious is a product of civilization. And McLuhan used the word civilization as a technical term to describe the effects of writing and what later he called abstract visual space. So when Thompson begins the recognition of this civilizational unconscious, that's correct in McLuhan's terms, the civilizational unconscious. And he's going to run through an inventory of people starting to pick up this product in McLuhan terms of visual space. And he runs through the various analysts of the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
So the recognition of this unconscious is the end of a process that began intellectually in the early 20th century. That jives with McLuhan in the sense that it's a process that sort of completes itself. So it begins with Freud dealing with the instinctive unconscious, then Jung bringing in the not-so-biological part, but imagery or the mind and how that had collective bias.
Yeah, because with Freud, if we're dealing with instinct, we're dealing with pure biology. With Jung, when we're dealing with the archetypes within the collective unconscious, we're looking at how the artifacts that men have made have become part of the memory of the biological and therefore sort of quasi-instinctual. But these are epigenetic phenomena because we're dealing with culturally made objects.
Yeah, second nature stuff, in McLuhan terms. Science, poetry, and dreams. But science and poetry, the imagery... Now, note that science and poetry, the imagery that Jung is referring to is the imagery that's collected in the oral tradition and in the written tradition, from manuscripts up to the printed books. So he is describing the actual effect of literacy and calling it an unconscious. And dreams would go back before literate man, but some people say that primitive people are dream awake.
Jung is dealing with like I remember looking at man and his symbols and flipping through and looking at some of the patterns that Jung considered to be archetypal, and a lot of times they revolved around artifacts that were made by the hands of human beings, like they made they sculpted out of stone this image of a sort of pregnant woman, this faceless woman, and it had a universal appeal because he found this kind of imagery in other cultures on other parts of the planet. So it wasn't like one culture infected another culture with it. All evolving human beings in different areas of the world, Homo sapiens, arrived at the same imagery on their own. So there was something where the instinctive was feeding into the development of the of symbolic imagery in the mind. Not dealing so much with words per se, or the effect of writing per se, as much as with images, cultural images.
Yeah, maybe imagery, pre-literate societies, the imagery that was common to pre-literate societies all over the world, and then he sees a reflection of those imageries in later civilized artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Science and poetry.
Mm-hmm. Because when he was doing psychoanalysis, I think he was largely, asking people. Well, he was asking them to dig around within their dream states for images, for what happened to you when you were dreaming. Well, I was in this dark, wet cave, and this hairy thing came and grabbed my foot. That's very tactile, and it's imagery, and it's not words or writing so much.
Right, but it's writing in the oral world that's developed. I mean, he is speaking to his patients and clients. It is the perspective of the past from the present bias of literate civilization and actually moving into the electric age in Jung's life.
Right.
The thing is that Freud is seeing it with biological or instinctive food, sex, and death, I guess. Those processes he's looking into how they affect people's culture. Jung is looking at the other part, the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the body-mind split. Jung starts looking at patterns in the mind. Remember when we did McLuhan on the archetype versus the cliche, that he said the archetype is largely a repeated pattern within literacy. It's an effect. It's an idea that comes out of literacy, whereas the cliche comes out of pre-literate societies.
I don't understand that distinction so much. I think of an archetype as being a massive cliche that's gone way underground, and then if it arises in some context within the daily life of human beings in terms of their a new logo or idea that arises in or a fad that emerges in culture, then it becomes a cliche.
Well, that's McLuhan. I agree with you. That was the title of the book, From Cliche to Archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you just say that an archetype was a cliche that went underground?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what he would say. Now, the reason it goes underground is that you move into the literate civilization phase of human cultural evolution. It wasn't underground in primitive societies. Remember, some societies talked about their dreams every day.
Right. But the reason why it went underground was because it was like it was a huge, massive cultural environment that became superseded by, when the new technology came in and changed, then this massive, you know, culture of the past goes underground in terms of being an archetype. But it can be retrieved as in a smaller context as kind of a fad within the new environment. Then it's a cliche.
Yeah, and that's the very process McLuhan talked about, the cliche archetype retrieval process. Now, what's interesting, I would say that Thompson is expressing in these various phases, he doesn't get to the point that McLuhan made, and he doesn't come to a particular understanding of the unconscious as an expression of the cultural technology. He doesn't make that clear, but he describes the parts of the evolution of this concept in the 20th century and comes up to McLuhan, knocks on his door, but doesn't want to hear or recognize what door he's knocked on. Because look at the next phase. After Jung, the third wave came in Paris with people like Lévi-Strauss and Foucault, who studied the intellectual unconscious. That's visual space.
Mm-hmm.
Foucault looked at the epoch from the 17th century to now and said there was a hidden framework that unites economics, linguistic, theory, art, and philosophy. Yet no one in the 17th century was really aware of these hidden correspondences. McLuhan wrote a whole book on that phase. You know, the book, The Gutenberg Galaxy, was about the common framework that united economics, linguistic theory, art, philosophy, and many other things.
Mm-hmm.
So that what Thompson, he's going from the collective unconscious of Jung to an intellectual unconscious. If the intellectual unconscious is something different, it is the product of the printed book, which is a new environment which alters humans and their unconscious in relation to the instinctive unconscious of Freud and the collective and imagistic unconscious that Jung talks about.
Which are both still, well, one's instinctual, which is biological, and then the other, the imagery one, when we get to Jung, we're dealing with tribal collective unconscious. And then when we get to the Gutenberg galaxy, we're precipitating the individual identity out from the tribal. So we're dealing with an unconscious which is made up of individuals.
Right. It caused by the medium of print.
Right.
And other parts that came in, other media that came in with that period.
This is where I think that the astral plane became fractioned into like all these different... People talk about going to the astral plane, they go to all these different little worlds and ecological niches and stuff where people live, or where you could, you know, like the Indians have the great grazing plains or whatever, and the Catholics have the God sitting, you know, in a throne. There are all these different astral places you can go into, but in the old tribal days, the astral plane, there was only one place to go. There were maybe two places to go, and one you didn't want to go to, and one maybe you did, but they were all pretty generic.
Right.
So I think as the individual got fractioned out of the Gutenberg galaxy, the astral plane became many more multidimensional places, ecologies, places that people could go to and visit.
Yeah, the environment... The imagery that people have of the astral plane is a human byproduct of human imagination, which is influenced by the media.
Yeah.
So, and Thompson does show that in a later book of the changing images of the death plane, the astral plane, and he shows it as a product of different cultural phases, what he calls the cultural ecology, what McLuhan would call a medium.
Right.
And so...
But he still thinks the astral plane is a real place. He doesn't think it's just a figment of human imagination. He thinks that it really is a place that people go when they die.
Right, but our images of it when we're not there are reflected in culture.
Yeah.
And now, instinct...
So the this
is the 10th time I've tried to get to this point. Jung, instinct... Now, it was okay you brought up those other things, but let me just say this, then we can digress again. Jung is dealing with instinct reflected in imagery, creating consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
The imagery, that is human culture.
Mm-hmm.
So how much the overlap between Freud's instinctive stuff and the imagery that's in the more mental or collective unconscious in the imagery is the fine overlap there. But there, if there is Was Jung aware that? Was Jung aware of Levi-Strauss and Foucault? I don't think so. Was he aware that they found another unconscious? And the only way you can distinguish that unconscious from the first two, Freud and Jung's, is the media dynamic, which is what McClone's talking about.
Yeah.
So there's
another unconscious, which was postulated, which Terence McKenna spoke about. I don't know what Thompson sources that Terence McKenna was pulling from. It was partly an original idea on his part, but partly he was relying on peers, but I don't know who they were, was the idea that, and this was because of his experiences of encountering the other in the psychedelic state, he believed that the collective unconscious was actually some kind of a creature that had its own will and volition.
Yeah, I'd say that's Terence McKenna picking up on the Android meme. He was a product of, he changed, his imagery of the astral plane was influenced by the environment of the 70s and 80s, which was the beginning of the Android meme, which was something that, what'd you say, took on a life of its own? Or
yeah, it had its own will and volition.
Sounds like the Android meme, or the idea that technology takes on a life of its own.
Yeah, and it also is kind of maybe a projection from the idea of Gaia, that the Earth is an organism, a sentient creature, that is looking after its own, you know, ecology and self-interest on some level, and creating earthquakes on the surface to try to shake up the human beings that are killing it.
That's the projecting first nature into the Android meme, emphasizing the Gaia imagery.
Right.
The romanticization or divinization of the imagery we have of first nature, which came out of the literacy phase of cataloging nature framed in visual space, which was not the nature that actual primitive peoples lived in.
Right.
So Levi-Strauss, he says, went off to the Amazon and showed how, if you look at all of the mythologies of South America, there are these hidden patterns and hidden structures that the people telling stories don't see. It's only the ethnographer writing the mythology who can show you the intellectual unconscious. So he's saying Levi-Strauss and Foucault both were working on the culturally made unconscious, what he called the intellectual unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
So I still see, it's sophisticated to go through those phases, but I see that he's missing and leaving out McLuhan's point about the unconscious. I don't know if Thompson noticed McLuhan's writings on the unconscious. So the next phase is Gregory Bateson, using cybernetics, show that there's actually a civilizational unconscious, that mind. I guess he's saying Bateson proved there was a civilizational unconscious. That mind is not separate from nature. That mind is in nature. And that, in many ways, the ecology is the unconscious of the societal system. Now, that phrase, the ecology is the unconscious of the societal system, that's like saying the ecology is the medium, the unconscious of the societal system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting how Thompson slips past McLuhan and comes up with a good restatement of what McLuhan was talking about in, was it four or five phases? I guess Freud and then Jung and then Foucault and Levi-Strauss, two aspects of the intellectual unconscious, and then Bateson, the fourth phase, proving that these weren't theories.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow proving. And that what we have in pollution, for example, is a real expression of the being of humanity in this moment of time. What we have in our conscious structures, our institutions, are the Disneyland movie sets. What's interesting is he's looking at the media in the global theater and calling it a hologramic Disneyland movie set, but that's actually the media, in McLuhan terms, that are causing the unconscious and the images of pollution.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it, in relation to McLuhan, useful but missing a chunk. But Thompson wouldn't be Thompson if he didn't ignore McLuhan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also this brings up something I thought about when I was looking at this earlier, which is a distinction that could be made between McLuhan and Thompson on this point, is that between LaRouche and Thompson, not McLuhan and Thompson. LaRouche wrote, I remember reading, I don't know how fast he holds to this, but I remember reading one of his newspapers, he published an article of the effect that he thought that the anthropomorph anthropomorphizing animals through cartoon characters, through Disney cartoon characters, was a terrible disservice to human beings. That it somehow equated this kind of human intelligence or creativity in the minds of children with animals, and that he thought that, you know, animals should be relegated to the realm of animals and humans should be relegated to the realm of humans, and there should not be blurring the lines.
Yeah.
But Thompson was totally, as a kid, totally inspired his imagination when he watched Fantasia.
Yeah.
And there were mystical ideas that were embroidered into Fantasia. And he saw that as being something which sparked and illuminated his imagination and got him going in the direction that he wanted to go in. And, of course, LaRouche would have the point of view that that was total nonsense. You should never have been, you know, infected with that virus.
Yeah, yeah, he said Thompson, because LaRouche used to complain about the Lindisfarne Foundation and Thompson's work and say they were part of the oligarch's satanic Aristotelian mind blurring.
Right.
They were mind cults almost, and that he really disliked the Thompson Enterprise. And you just explained why he would. He would consider this whole replay of the evolution of culture that was inspired by Fantasia and led to Thompson's writings in the 60s, in the 70s and 80s. He would say, man, that's, Lewis would say, that's an example of a damaged brain from watching too much Disney.
Yeah.
You know, we did discuss some of LaRouche's statements on the unconscious.
Right.
Just an example, here on page 12, here he's talking about traditional neurotic problems of the unconscious, sort of coming out of psychoanalysis slightly, even though LaRouche wasn't a complete fan of Freud.
But he liked the Kirby Gestalt.
Yeah, Kubi's Gestalt.
Kubi.
So, Gestalt therapy. So here's what LaRouche says. In this sense, the neurotic adult must be systematically regarded as a pseudo-adult, either as the victim of individual neurosis or of that collective neurosis recognized as bourgeois ideology. So he's agreeing with Foucault, and this is sort of a superficial matching, but it's interesting. The collective neurosis recognizes a bourgeois ideology is the same thing that Thompson's saying that Foucault recognized. And he's saying Foucault called it, or he calls Foucault's, an intellectual unconscious. LaRouche is calling that intellectual unconscious bourgeois ideology. Mm. And he's saying it's a collective neurosis.
Yeah.
He says this person, neurotic person, his sense of identity is pathologically determined by childish fantasies, there's your fantasia, and not by self-consciousness of its positive basis for adult existence.
Mm-hmm.
By contrast, the revolutionary is essentially the only true adult, by contrast with the pseudo-adult children about him.
Mm-hmm.
So Thompson is pandering to the pseudo-adult children about him.
Mm-hmm.
The neurotic loves his wife as a surrogate for his mother. The adult loves his mother and father not as internalized images, but as actual human beings, and loves his wife as an actual human being in her own right. Now, Thompson would agree with that ideology. They're disagreeing over the big picture.
Yeah.
He has put aside his mother and father, that's the mature person, who becomes specially loved peers on the outside of his identity, and locates his identity in the adult woman who has become the focus of his sense of identity. In another section, he goes, in the case of the individual clinging to the bourgeois infantile ego, either through the mediation of the mother image or the love object of a banalized sexual relationship, the experiencing of even a significant outpouring of the fundamental emotion is an experience of psychological near death. That's for the neurotic. So there's LaRouche. We'll just bring back LaRouche's version of the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so...
I want to postulate something. It's always bugged me a little bit that there can't be... You know, you got these psychoanalysts talking about the unconscious mind, and then you have these metaphysicians talking about the astral plane, which is also happens to be unconscious to the average person.
Yeah.
So is it that these are two distinct realms that aren't even tangential to one another, or are they in fact looking at the same thing from different perspectives?
Well, the psychoanalysis tradition comes out of the era of the chemical body, you know, the 1850 to 1950, say, you know, where people believed we were a biological organism, had one life. That was the general secular meme that people operated in, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were people who believed in life after death in the Catholic religion and Protestant religion and other religions, but the mainstream culture was looking and regarding the unconscious as part of the chemical body.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Maybe right. Even there were factions of professors that didn't even believe there was an unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Or they, you know, that would be maybe the Skinner gang, the Skinner box people, the behaviorists, mm-hmm. just thought we were stimulus response programmable entities, chemical bodies. The astral plane is a tradition that comes out of pre-chemical body knowledge and is retrieved in post-chemical body environments, like the TV era. And we have the advantage of seeing both cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So from our position, which is neither in a chemical body position or TV body position, but in the interval between them and the chip body and the astral body, we could see how there is a common, they were describing the same thing through their societal conditioning.
Right. However, the unconscious has been described as being sort of a passive, you know, like the Joyce's midden heap, you know,
yeah.
A passive dumping ground for past memories.
Yes.
However, the astral plane, we know, like through conversations with the Evergreen, is a very busy place. It's very
the Evergreen's being 6,000 to 7,000 entities that come through the deep trance psychic Michael Black Reed, just for people to understand. That's people. If you believe they are channeling entities from somewhere else, you were saying
this dimension is very much alive and active, and
the astral plane.
Yeah. It's not a mid. It's no midden heap. It's an alive ecology.
Yeah, but we can't prove that. We haven't got the measuring instruments yet.
Yeah,
it's an act of faith or intellectual choice whether you want to take that information seriously or not.
Mm-hmm.
So Thompson takes that information seriously. He operates that there is an astral plane.
Right,
and he. He's unique because he's bringing in, he's in the interval between chemical body knowledge and astral body knowledge and a little bit of media knowledge, and he plays the three off each other. So he's tactile in that sense. He's in the gap between them, and that's what makes his writings unique.
Well, now, McKenna used to take the middle ground. He didn't, he tended to want to argue against all the people that said that the astral plane was real just because he kind of wanted to put the brakes on a little bit and say, whoa, slow down. We don't really know what we're looking at here. Are we looking at some dimension of our own inner self being reflected back to ourselves, or are we truly looking at something that is other? Now, the experience that McKenna had was when he was encountering the other in psychedelic states and having a dialogue with it and learning things from it which he didn't think could ever have come from his own brain, his own mind, because he was learning new things he'd never thought about before in dialogue with what he called the other. But he always questioned whether or not that other really was out there, was somebody else, or was it just some deep conversation he was having with his own DNA.
Right, so he was agnostic on whether there was an astral plane or not.
Right.
And he was willing to say, sort of cite the mystery body in the sense of, well, we don't know what we're experiencing.
Right.
But he said, did you say that he did project there may have been another dimension out there?
Well, he encountered it. He just didn't know what the source of it was.
Right. So, and he became interested in Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan.
Yeah.
And he did dialogues with Thompson's colleague, Ralph Abraham.
Yeah.
And Rupert Sheldrake was
in Rupert. Rupert Sheldrake.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that Thompson ends with Bateson, who is a member of Thompson's Lindisfarne Institute, contributed to Lindisfarne, and was an important thinker influencing Thompson. So he ends with his own thinking via Gregory Bateson, that in many ways, quote, the ecology is the unconscious of the societal system, which is sort of McLuhan. So what we have in pollution, for example, is a real expression of the being of humanity in this moment of time. What we have in our conscious structures, our institutions, are the Disneyland movie sets. So he's doing a figure ground there. I don't know if Bateson would agree with this, but he sees Bateson as giving him the backing for saying that pollution is our unconscious. It's the extension that we're ignoring and the effects, the complex of effects we're ignoring. So he's saying what we experience in our media society as Disneyland movie sets are the figure, and the ground is a collective unconscious, which is whatever we think is polluting us.
Mm-hmm.
So you project back through Freud as seeing some kind of pollution, calling it the instinct of life. The instinctive unconscious or the instinctive life is the pollution. Then Jung sees the pollution as the mental imagery and cultural artifacts. And then Foucault sees the pollution as a intellectual unconscious. And Levi-Strauss too, and then Bateson points it out, it is pollution. So I think McLuhan's idea of the services and disservices, and McLuhan called the Global Theater Planet Polluto, that an inventory of all the disservices and services which are unconscious, not just the polluted part, but the services have figure efficiencies and satisfactions, but there are a lot of unconscious satisfactions that have pro and con effects. So McLuhan maybe produces a more comprehensive view of the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
That since the term media is so specific in our society, people didn't see that that's what McLuhan was offering. So it's good to have Thompson redo McLuhan and come up with the same conclusion in new terms.
Yeah, but he sees the sort of pollution of the unconscious. Turning into
the effluence? EFL, because that's what it is, the effluence.
Yeah.
Affluence.
Right, exactly. But he sees it as Thompson's viewing that in terms of conscious structures such as our institutions, Disneyland movie sets. Now, I don't think it's fair to collectivize
these dynamic environments as mere Disneyland movie sets.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was McLuhan's critique of those that saw the new media as pseudo-events. Thompson is dismissing in his dropout mode all of these massive technological environments as mere pseudo-events.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's what that's weak on Thompson's part.
Yeah.
If you like McLuhan.
Yeah.
So let's look at. Let me just run through the quote.
Yeah.
So just replay that quickly in review. The recognition of this civilizational unconscious, this hidden cultural reality, is the end of a process that began intellectually in the early 20th century. Freud began with the instinctive unconscious. Jung followed him and reflected the instinctive life into consciousness as it was created in the collective unconscious and reflected in patterns of imagery that would occur in science or poetry or dreams or the rest of it. It wasn't instinct. It was instinct reflected in imagery creating consciousness. The third wave came in Paris with people like Levi-Strauss and Foucault who studied the intellectual unconscious. Foucault looked at the epoch from the 17th century to now and said there is a hidden framework that unites economics, linguistic theory, art, and philosophy. Yet no one in the 17th century was really aware of these hidden correspondences. So Foucault, in a sense, discovered the intellectual unconscious. Levi-Strauss went off to the Amazon and showed how if you look at all of the mythologies of South America, there are these hidden patterns and hidden structures that the people telling the stories don't see. It's only the ethnographer writing the mythology who can show you the intellectual unconscious. Now, in the late 60s, following the work of the French thinkers, Gregory Bateson using cybernetics, Thompson is saying here that he used a technology for his model. Gregory Bateson, using cybernetics, showed that there is actually a civilizational unconscious, that mind is not separate from nature, that mind is in nature, and that in many ways the ecology is the unconscious of the societal system. So what we have in pollution, for example, is a real expression of the being of humanity in this moment of time. What we have in our conscious structures, our institutions, are the Disneyland movie sets. One thing where he says back here, it was instinct reflected in the imagery creating consciousness. Creating consciousness. So is he saying that the that consciousness itself is somehow hooked into the collective unconscious?
Yeah, well, consciousness has to have something to reflect upon in order to know itself. And when it starts creating imagery, it gives it something to reflect upon.
Yeah, so it's a figure ground thing there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go on to the next quote, which is from a book by Thompson. It came out in 1989. It's called Imaginary Landscape, Making Worlds of Myth and Science. And this is page in the introduction, pages XV and XVI, which would be 15 and 16, in the forward, preface, or introduction, whatever it is. Now, what's interesting, he comments on McLuhan and Bucky Fuller here. So here's McLuhan comparing, and here's Thompson comparing his team to the McLuhan gang. So have you read this? This is from a book written in came out in 1989, The Imaginary Landscape.
When one moves from the academies of philosophy into mind jazz, one can never tell who is going to play in a way that makes a jam session possible. Some people's books are great, but the people themselves are so autistic they cannot listen to anyone else to shift their own tunes in response or an exploration of new implications of their old patterns of thinking. They have been so isolated in their life by their own gifts and never having found colleagues, they become shaped by adversaries into...
By adversity into
cosmic soloists. But because their gifts are respected, they are not tagged as insane and are accepted as gurus. Both Bucky Fuller and Marshall McLuhan suffered from this kind of cosmic autism and ended up, through multiple recitals of their ideas, becoming holographic tape recordings of themselves. Messiahs to the electronic media, they became its sacrificial victims and showed how the United States dulls bright minds with spotlights. People like Ralph Abraham, Jim Lovelock, Lynn Margulis, and Francisco Valera seemed much more open to a kind of intellectual chamber music in which we all learned and changed from playing with one another.
That's Francisco Varela. Okay.
Okay.
Next paragraph.
So, as the New Age movement began to define the new as Paleolithic shamanism, Neolithic feminism, pharaonic architecture, and medieval Islamic geometry, I moved away to stand next to the instrumentalists who were playing new tunes or new and interesting variations of old ones. It didn't happen all at once, and for a while I was stuck between two stations and was picking up a lot of noise. I was no longer tuned to the MIT of the 1960s, and I was no longer tuned to the holy men and gurus of the 70s, but I had not yet met the scientists with whom I would work in the 80s.
Right, so he's summing up the change he went through. He's talking about the change he went through and left his 70s self as it became commercialized in the 80s, the New Age movement. He called it the planetization of the esoteric. He was alienated from that kind of mass marketing, like the way you heard the UFOs on the news today and didn't like that. The quotes we've been using, the last two or three quotes from mid-80s and early 90s, represent his thinking after he's moved out of his 70s thought pattern. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I said he went through a change. Now he's saying it right here. But he might have said it in some articles around the same time, but it's right there in this book that comes out in the late 80s. So he's explaining how he was different in the 80s. So what's interesting is that he wants to, like a baby boomer, he's into music and oral culture. And so he wants his academy to be playing like a jazz band, improvising.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees Fuller and McLuhan, he's projecting on them as very literate, isolated, individualistic and autistic people, lost in...
He thinks they became caricatures of themselves cliches of themselves, in a sense, under the media spotlight.
Right.
Now, you're forced to, if you have to explain yourself over and over and over to the media, mass media market, you probably have a tendency to start becoming like an ingrown toenail, repeating yourself and trying to figure out how to get people to get, how to get your message across.
Yeah, now what's interesting is Thompson was kind of a guru, intellectual guru like McLuhan. He was seen as a McLuhan of the 70s, and he didn't like any kind of, he reacted pretty negative to the media exposure he got in the 1979-1980 on the Bill Moyer show, as I mentioned earlier, and he didn't want to become a sacrificial victim. He even said that he told Terrence McKenna that he would become a sacrificial victim like Leary. So we have here, he's looking at the media dynamics more in his analysis, but he's still remaining, you know, out there in Boulder, Colorado, or in the mountains of Colorado where his retreat was. He's still looking down at the futility of communicating an idea in the media noise.
Mm-hmm.
So what he would do is he would have these conferences once a year where Ralph Abraham and Lovelock and Margulis and Varela, the people he mentions in this section, would come and update and be like an academic conference, but it would be done in a Buddhist, almost Buddhist-like meditative retreat, and these people would get to interact with each other. I never attended any of them. I don't know what the quality was like. It might have been just like an academic series of panels, but people